I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of one man's memorial tattoos, how he remembers the dead with an RIP. Garrett Sample, G to his friends, grew up in Philadelphia. His younger brother Vance dropped out of school at age 14, choosing a faster life on the street. G says that Vance just couldn't see why school mattered.
Just as if you see on TV, there's no money in that. There's nothing fast. School is it's a slow walk, and that's not something he wanted to do.
Vance was only 18 years old when he died. Soon after that, G had a memorial tattoo put on his left shoulder. Vance's name, RIP, and a pistol. In later years, he got more tattoos when his grandparents died and then when a close friend was killed.
I grieve differently than other people. You know, some people do tears. You know, I do tattoos.
Memorial tattoos, an exploration of the illustrated man. I'll talk with G and his favorite tattoo artist, Jeff. That's coming up right after the news. Garrett Sample goes by the name of G. If you ask him to talk about his art collection, all G has to do is look at the RIP tattoo he had put on his right shoulder after his friend was murdered.
Coming out of the scroll, you know, we had like roses, vines with thorns, arrows for strength. We had a lion's head coming out to show that he was a warrior. The lion was always the king of the jungle. So it showed strength.
G's upper body is now a gallery of tattoo art, much of it done by one man, Jeff Bradbury. G has a heart monitor tattooed on his chest and phrases that have caught his attention. I live by knowledge, it's the key to self-preservation, is on his forearm. But to get him telling his stories, ask him about the RIP tattoos he wears. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Garrett Sample, most people call him G, is an artist in his own right with cars. He lives in Philadelphia and works as a full-time mechanic. When he was younger, he lived with his brother and his sister and his mother in Germantown. It's always been one of Philly's toughest neighborhoods. Even today, it's in the news for its shootings and home invasions. G's teenage brother Vance was attracted to the fast life on the street. He died of a heroin overdose at the age of 18. G was looking for a way to honor his brother's short life and decided to get a tattoo.
At the time, I wasn't really into tattoos really like that. I think I might have had one, and none of them were, you know, RIP tattoos. But basically, when I was younger, I was stealing cars. So it just so happened my mother put me into a weightlifting program. So a lot of the guys, my instructor that I was working out with, a lot of them had tattoos. And when he passed on, I had started asking about them. You know, you hear stories here and there about different diseases and, you know, that they hurt and things like that. So it wasn't a big deal, but that's pretty much where I got the information from.
I'm trying to figure out what it was that led you to get the tattoo. If it wasn't so trendy back in the mid-90s, why did you think that, you know, remembering your brother with a tattoo was something that you wanted to do?
Well, tattoos are forever. You know, it's pictures are something that, you know, something can happen to them. They can get damaged, you know, they can get scarred. And you always want something that's going to give you that perfect picture of a person that you remember them by. To the day I leave this earth, that tattoo will be on my arm. And I don't like to grieve. And getting that tattoo of him, it's always like seeing him smile every time I see it. And that's the way I remember him, not in the bad ways, but definitely in the good way.
The younger brother Vance had often been in trouble. G and his sister and their mother had all tried to help him, but Vance had been determined to live a life that was different.
And my brother was always kind of like the rebellious type. So, you know, we got along just as well as any other siblings would, but as we got older, I would say around the ages about like 14, you know, things got a little bit worse. And, you know, parents kind of put that scare into you about if you don't want to follow my rules, you can get out. And it didn't work for him. And he moved out at age 14.
Huh. Into what? Where?
He moved with a friend of his that he went to school with. It was only about maybe 5-6 blocks away from my house. But he also had a baby at 14.
Boy, that's a lot of responsibility for someone that age.
Yeah, it is.
So once he left, were you guys close or did you drift apart a bit?
I think we drifted apart more. You know, he had dropped out of school and, you know, I would see him throughout the day. And as I saw him throughout the day, you know, I asked him, how's he doing? You know, are you back in school? Trying to be that positive role model. And, you know, it wasn't working. You know, he hung around a lot of older guys, and they weren't exactly the best role models either. So it was a matter of him, I guess you could say, you know, hanging with the cool crowd. And your older brother is in school, and he's trying to push you for that. And just as if you see on TV, there's no money in that. There's nothing fast. School is, it's a slow walk, and that's not something he wanted to do.
When you say he was hanging with the cool crowd, talk to me a little bit more about that. I mean, what kind of life was he living?
It was always good for me that, you know, I would get off the bus, come home from school, and somebody I know, you know, they're telling me, oh, well, you know, your brother shot somebody, and you got to have a talk with them. And a lot of times it was over stuff that was, like, really mediocre, you know, because he was selling drugs, and somebody might have owed him some money or, you know, something of that sort, and, you know, he might have, you know, shot the guy in the leg or something like that. So a lot of the guys that he hung with were, well, I would say 10 to 15 years older than him. Uh-huh. You know, you're talking about like 25, maybe 30 years old, whether it was somebody he just hung with or maybe somebody, you know, he purchased his drugs from or whatever. But basically that was the crowd he hung with. He was even, you know, driving cars with no license at that time.
Do you ever take him aside and just say, you know, Vince, you're not going to live to see much of your old age if you keep behaving like this?
Yeah, I mean, I tell everybody, there's only so much you can do. You can't force anybody's hand. It's all a matter of how you want to see your future. You know, I would try to drill it into him that basically, you know, you have a child now and you got to think about their future and things of that sort. But it really it didn't help the situation at all. And, you know, we got tired of getting plenty of phone calls at nighttime about Vance has been locked up for, you know, having a gun, things of that sort. And then they would lock you up and you could, like, sign your own self out.
How is it, G, that you stuck with school and Vance didn't? Why did you stay in?
I don't know. Like I said, I've always picked up on things quick. I've always had an interest in things I saw. You know, I have uncles that was in the military and watched them grow and see what kind of things they've had. And not wanting to be a casualty had a lot to do with it also. I just was, you know, I was the brother that played the safe route.
When did you hear that something was wrong with Vance? I mean, how did you get the bad news about your brother?
The situation with him passing on was as a surprise to everyone. When I got the phone call that he had died, you know, it was kind of bad to say, but always expecting the unexpected, they said that he died of a drug overdose. He died in his sleep.
Did this surprise you when you heard that?
It surprised me, but to a point it was kind of almost to a point of ease because I've seen people, you know, get shot and die from that. And I guess to a point I was at my end. I didn't know what was going to happen to him. You know, you never expect that phone call. You see this kind of stuff on the news, but it always hits harder when it hits home. So, you know, once I got the information down and everything, they basically said he died in his sleep. So to a point, it was kind of relieved that he died peacefully. But instantly in your head, it's like you don't know what your next move is going to be.
How old was he at the time, G?
He was 18.
And you?
I was 19.
How did you take the news?
I was kind of numb. There were no tears or anything like that. I was hurt because as we got past that stage and he got about 17 or 18, we actually started getting along a lot better. So I think it was a matter of not the fact that he was gone. It was the fact that we didn't have an opportunity to really get to enjoy each other as brothers.
Shortly after Vance died, and this was years ago now, G decided to get that tattoo to honor him. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Since that time, the tattoo has been changed and expanded, and we'll talk about that later. I asked G to tell me about that first tattoo he had done at a place called Popcorns.
Well, at the time, when I got his tattoo, I had been talking to a couple people, and I saw a Rest in Peace tattoo, and they told me, you know, they got it from off Popcorns. I mean, they had been open maybe like 4 or 5 months. And like with anything, with it's new, you're kind of skeptical. So I just, you know, took a trip up there and looked around and things of that sort. And it was very plain. It was just like his name and it was like I had got a gun put underneath it. And, you know, at the time I was younger and my mentality was just different. That's just the way I always remembered him. Him always carrying a gun, this, that, and the third. And just maybe, I say maybe like 2 or 3 years went by, and I don't know if me as a person just evolving, getting older, that wasn't the way I wanted to remember him, in a complete whole.
So later, G decided to revamp that RIP tattoo. He went to talk with Jeff Bradbury at Popcorn's Tattoo Shop in Philadelphia. Jeff says that working with people in mourning has its ups and downs, but he believes that his work transforms grief into art that people can appreciate.
He wasn't one of those immediate guys who came in and was like, my brother just died, I need a tattoo. He only had one tattoo. It was his brother. And it really affected him deeply. He wanted to change the memorial. He just asked me to hook it up.
I'd never seen anybody with a scroll. And, you know, Jeff said, well, look, you know, scrolls are a good way. It's almost like a biblical way to do it. And he was like, you know, there's things that I can do to kind of broaden it. And he said, pretty much, you just tell me certain things about him that you would like to remember. And, you know, we'll go from there with it.
It was just a real simple RIP. That's all it was. RIP initialed, and underneath it in larger script, the name Vance.
He just started drawing things around it, and before I knew it, like it pretty much took up my whole shoulder.
Can you see it from where you're sitting right now?
No. Only time I usually can see is like if I'm, you know, if I'm bathing or anything like that, but it wraps around my shoulder, so you can see like the side of it. But I mean, every morning I wake up, if I look in the mirror, I can see it perfect.
And is that a moment when you stop to think about your brother? Is that the point?
I think it was, you know, that was my cleansing period, you know. It's almost like retiring a jersey, you know. It's like even though you're retiring a jersey, you know, in spirit, the person is still here. You'll always remember, you know, the things they did and how they did it and the effect they had on you in your particular life, or more or less in the particular lives of other people that you were close with.
And there's something about this tattoo that's better than having a framed photograph of your brother.
Oh, definitely. Just more or less the fact that it's with me forever. What's going to happen when I'm 80, 90 years old and, you know, I'm starting to lose my mind, things of that sort. If I ever get hurt, if I'm in the hospital, anytime I take my shirt off and anybody sees it, you know, they can always ask me or always see that that person was important to me. And, you know, once it's questionable, I'm always more than happy to, you know, explain who he was and, you know, how he affected me.
G says he's still lifting weights and that these days it's important not only to stay fit, but to keep those tattoos looking good. People will see them and he gets that chance to tell the stories of the people who've died. I'll talk more with G and with the tattoo artist Jeff in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The RIP tattoo tells more than just the story of the person who died. In a broader sense, it tells the story of the place where the person died. The new mayor of Philadelphia took office last week, declaring a crime emergency. Last year, there were close to 400 murders in Philadelphia, and there are today as many as 5 shootings every day. This is where Jeff Bradbury works as a tattoo artist. Last year, someone was shot in the head in front of his home as he left for work. Jeff has since moved from there, but he still commutes to that same neighborhood to work at Popcorn's Tattoo Parlor. Jeff told me about one family that came in, the older brother in one family, who got a tattoo to remember his mother.
I remember a couple times where people just came right in. There was these young kids, and their mom just died. She was young, and she was a beautiful woman. The boys were grieving, like you could see the life was out of their eyes, and they were so sad. That really stuck with me. That's heavy to me. Like, I feel that weight right now, you know? I guess about 2 or 3 years later, his younger brother came, and his younger brother got the same portrait done on his arm, and that made me feel really good. for some strange reason, it made me feel like that it was a positive experience for the older brother, which in turn made the younger brother want to experience the same thing with the tattoo.
I was talking earlier with Garrett Sample. Everyone calls him G. He's seen Jeff to get memorial tattoos for his brother and his friend and his grandparents. G says the tattoo will trigger a story and often even a connection.
Oh, that's definite, you know, and I still get that now, especially in the summertime, you know, if I'm wearing like a tank top or something. And it's so crazy, this world is so small, because, you know, there's been times where I've actually been in a different part of Philadelphia and, you know, people have seen it. And I've actually had people say, you know, they had a friend named, you know, Vance, and it just so turned out they knew him.
Huh. So that connection wouldn't be made if someone hadn't seen your shoulder.
Pretty much, or nobody would even ask or things of that sort, you know. He was kind of a ladies' man, so the majority of the time it's a woman.
He'd like that, I guess.
Yeah, trust me, he's definitely smiling down, trust me.
Now, it would have been, what, a year after Vance died when you got another RIP tattoo?
Yeah, the friend that he lived with got shot and killed. We all pretty much grew up together and went to school together. And his name was Isaac, but we, like, called him Ikey. And same part of town, maybe, like, two blocks from my house, got into an argument with somebody, and they shot him.
And did you immediately think, I'm going to get an RIP tattoo with Ike's name on it, or did that come over time?
I would say it came maybe about 2 weeks after. You know, it was so so sorry to see, and I grieve differently than other people. You know, some people do tears, you know, I do tattoos. And he was very close, I guess, because more or less it was a situation where, as though it's like, if you can't be around, you pretty much figure if somebody's going to watch over him, you want somebody that you trust, or you know somebody's going to, you know, look out for him when you're not around.
Yeah. Describe this one for me, the one that you had done for Ike.
He's very short, very strong, very outspoken. So we did something more or less. It was the same sort, like a scroll, but coming out of the scroll, you know, we had like roses, vines with thorns, arrows for strength. We had a lion's head coming out to show that he was a warrior. Lion was always the king of the jungle.
Uh-huh.
So it showed strength. And that's something that I wanted to show, you know, when I did that one.
Now, where is this one?
This one is on my right shoulder.
And is it as big as the one for your brother?
Almost, but mainly just on my shoulder. My brother's pretty much takes up the whole shoulder blade itself.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. G lives in a part of Philadelphia where RIP tattoos are common. Jeff Bradbury's a tattoo artist. He says the work in his shop's kind of like a barometer of what's going on in the community.
I don't know if I'd call it a dangerous block, but it's on a sketchy block right on the corner. But, you know, I mean, it's Philadelphia. It's like the Wild West out here. Most people that get killed in that community, someone at the tattoo shop knows. An example is one of the kids that literally grew up 200 feet from the tattoo shop was killed on his block, like right there. Mm. And it wasn't like no one went crazy and nobody, it wasn't like a big rush of people.
But how many memorial tattoos would you have done for him?
I've only done one on his sister. I'm sure there'll be more.
Why, was this a recent killing?
Yeah, 2 weeks maybe.
What did you do for his sister?
Just his name in fancy script. That's all she wanted.
Jeff says he does a lot of memorial tattoos these days. However, he'll always resist people who ask for a tattoo above the neck.
The way I see it is if you're going to tattoo your face, you're paying an exorbitant amount of money to get it done, straight up.
So if I come in and say, you know, I want this memorial tattoo, I want a teardrop on the outside corner of my eye, what do you say?
Are you really going to tattoo your face? I don't think it's a good idea.
But if I say, yeah, I want it, then what do? You just put the price up so high that you're trying to discourage me?
Yeah. I'd say, well, teardrops on the face start at $300. Take it or leave it. You know, I won't do a teardrop for $30 or something like that. Forget it. It's just a waste. It's a waste of time. And if you're that much of a waste of time, I'll gladly take all your money.
It's a good way of talking somebody out of it.
Yep, and you don't budge. Because I've already dismissed it. life is hard enough without a tattoo on your face.
You're listening to The Story. Jeff Bradbury and G. Sample have been telling me about memorial tattoos. I was curious about the ones that G. got after his grandparents died.
Yeah, they died years apart, but Jeff, he did one, and then he basically, you know, intertwined the two to make one complete.
It's kind of like what you would do with headstones. It's what they used to do anyway.
Pretty much. It was like an add-on. It was like an add-on, yeah.
And what's that? What have you got? Just give me a picture for someone who's imagining it.
Well, my grandmother, that was pretty simple in the beginning. It was just, you know, like a heart, and, you know, it had her name in it. And for a long time, you know, I always thought about, you know, doing something bigger. But I usually think my tattoos through now. And like I said, I want them to tell a story. So pretty much, you know, just with the heart, just saying that I loved her. But it just so happened, like last year, my grandfather died. So when we did that, they were, you know, two very biblical people. So Jeff just found ways to, you know, put like Christianity in that for them, and put like a big cross going through the center of my grandfather's name. But he interpreted the two, and right underneath it, he did a Bible with rosary beads hanging off of him, off of the Bible.
And where is this one on you?
It's right underneath the other one. So one is on my forearm and one is underneath my forearm.
So if you were to hold your two arms out, would I see tattoos basically from your shoulder to your wrist on both arms now?
Pretty much, yeah. I've got a lot. I think all together, Jeff's probably done about 16 tattoos on me.
Help me out with how you figure out where you want them. I mean, you know, is that something you'll leave up to Jeff, the tattoo artist? Or do you say, no, this person's extra special. I want her here. I want it there. How do you decide that?
Well, definitely that. I would never hide something that I definitely want people to ask me about. But Jeff usually kind of gives me a hand on that. It depends on the size of the tattoo. Usually if he says it's going to be a little bigger than ordinary, then we try to decide a place where it's going to look good just as well as it'll age properly and it'll still be seen.
You said to me a little bit earlier, G, that some people do tears and you do tattoos. Are you telling me that even when your grandparents died, you didn't cry, you went to the tattoo parlor? That's a sort of instead of, or what?
I don't know. Like I said, it's like to the point, you know, you grow up in different situations and you see so much. I guess you could say it's almost like war. You know, tears only help us so much. And I'm just like that. You know, it's very calm. Some people say it's cold. Some people think it's strange. But, you know, I just grieve differently than other people do. And I don't think it makes me, you know, less of a person. I don't know. I think it's just a matter of everything in one. It brings back past pains. And then I don't like to do that. You know, I try to think forward.
And when you go into the tattoo parlor then to have one done, are you emotional about that, or is it a fairly matter-of-fact thing, like more like a business transaction?
Nah, I wouldn't say it's a bit, but it's partly business, but I mean mainly it's definitely just about the tattoo. It's all about the tattoo and, you know, how it's going to turn out. And I don't know, while I'm getting it done, it gives me time to think. Usually when certain catastrophic things happen in a person's life, you know, you got a lot of people around you and they're telling you it's okay to cry and things like that. And, you know, that's what, you know, other people do. I just don't do that. So I'm so focused on the tattoo because it's almost like it's like a trophy for that person. I guess that's what makes it easy for me, whereas though I don't have to grieve. It's a cleansing process.
What do other people in the family think when they see the tattoos?
Well, my grandmother, she laughs and jokes. She says I have too many. But my dad's parents are still living. I'm very close to them. And, you know, my grandmother, she always says that I have tattoos like a sailor. But my sister, she comments a lot on it. You know, she says the same thing, I have too many. But they say things, but I just think that's their own way of making a joke out of it so they don't start getting upset. Yeah. But, you know, like I said, when you see a tattoo of somebody, it's just totally different.
What does your girlfriend think?
Well, she's nasty. You know, she likes my tattoos, period. But she just says that, you know, out of all the ones that I do have, she said that one she likes the best. You know, it's just more defined. It's more descriptive. And she says, believe it or not, she could tell that's the one that I put some of the most time into.
This is the one for Vance.
Yeah.
I'm making a list here as you're talking to me. There's your mother. You got two other brothers, a sister, mm-hmm. two mm-hmm. grandparents living. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were to get a tattoo for each one of these people, let's hope that they all don't pass before you. But have you got enough space there?
I'll make space. I'll make space. You know, I'm only 31 now. So you figure in the next 30, 40 years, you know, we're just looking after each other. We're not more or less worrying about getting tattoos for each other.
How old is your daughter, G?
She's 5.
So if she was 10 years old and said, hey, Dad, I want to get a tattoo, what would you say?
Wait till you're grown.
What's grown?
Well, she comments on it too a lot, you know. And
yeah, you're like a storybook, right?
Yeah, well, she always says, you know, Dad, you got a lot of tattoos and, you know, Daddy, you're big and strong and stuff like that. So it doesn't bother her. You know, she admires her father, you know, just not for the tattoos. You know, she admires me for the things that I do outside of tattoos. So, but it's kind of fun for her, where if I go pick her up and from summer camp or something like that, and, you know, all the little kids say, you know, that's your dad. Wow. So, you know, for her, it's cool.
I can imagine somebody listening to us thinking that the one thing about your tattoos is they're about dead people. They're like, you know, they're memorials in a way, and that you've kind of covered your body with sadness.
I don't think it's a matter of sadness. It helps me stay focused. Time is very important, and it's not promised. So you can say death, but, I mean, death is a part of life. Sadness, that's a part of life. You know, you got to take the good with the bad and learn how to deal with it.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm talking with Garrett Semple. He's better known as G. And with his tattoo artist, Jeff Bradbury, in Philadelphia, Jeff says he gets a lot of pleasure in the art of the tattoo.
If you can really tap into a form of art that you can translate into tattooing, it's always a breeze. It's always fun. There's no labor behind it. It's more of like a joy of the art form. And those are the tattoos that are great. I saw an awesome tattoo the other day. It was like a female longboard surfer, you know, with like a really beautiful orange sunset with like purple clouds behind her. Done traditionally, like folk style, nice fat outline and basic black shading and then color off the shading. A well-executed traditional tattoo. Smoking hot. The most beautiful tattoo.
Jeff Bradbury and G are talking with me about the place of the memorial tattoo today. G says even getting a tattoo is often a relationship that requires some intense trust.
And some of them I might not even be able to, depending on where it's at, I may not, you know, be able to see him while he's doing it. I may be turned around or, you know, in a kind of a funny position.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would make me a little nervous. You
know? Nah.
I want to know what's going on back there.
Nah. Jeff is like a surgeon, you know. Half the time when they're operating, you sleep, you pretty much can't ask the doctor, you know, you sure you know what you're doing when you move that spleen or something like that. So it's you have to learn to trust. And like I said, it's going on 13 years, almost 14 years with Jeff.
You have to touch this person. You have to be in contact with this person. They have to trust you, and you have to work together. And usually, for the most part, it's a joyous occasion, experience, even if it's terribly sad. You know, it's still something that you try to walk away with a positive experience with, which is another part of the pressure, you know.
I mean, if you're doing memorial tattoos, then you know that whoever you're working on has just lost a best friend or you know, a brother or something like that. There must be a fair amount of sadness in that exchange.
Yeah, there is. To be honest, I try to stay as distant as possible, you know, because you try your best to know your limits and know the borders, depending on, like, the weight of the situation, you know. I mean, there are some times when you'll catch a client who's really feeling very angry about what's going on, you know, and you got to handle that. It's a contact sport, man. There are a lot of days when you really have to shower at the end of the day, you know, where you just need to wash it all off.
The relationship that you guys have, like it's this, you know, artist to canvas, if you're the canvas, that's brought you guys pretty close together over the past 13 years.
Yeah, we talk all the time. You know, we talk just like brothers. We're very open, you know. It's not too often you can see two men stand in an open place and tell each other that they love them without, you know, somebody thinks something funny's going on. But, it's you meet everybody in your life for a reason, you know. I guess that's the reason why I met Jeff.
G. Semple and Jeff Bradbury are in Philadelphia. If you'd like to see G's memorial tattoos, we have photographs of them on our website at thestory.org. We also have a link to an interactive map of the homicides in that city. I'm also interested in knowing if you have a story that takes in the tale of the tattoo and maybe takes it in a different direction, something you'd like to add. Send me a couple of lines. Go to our website at thestory.org.
I remember we painted our names on the wall for fun. Now it's rest in peace after everyone except me. But I ain't the one in the front. Seems like I'm viewing a body every other month. Plus, I knew him when he was yay big. Pour a beer on the curb before I take a swig. But something ain't right. When it's a tragedy, that's the only time that the family's tight. Loving each other in a caring mood. There's lots of people and lots of food. They say be
coming up next, we will hear one of those stories about that moment in all of our lives when we do something really lame. You know what I'm talking about, breaking the prize family platter, leaning into that half-finished oil painting, spilling coffee into the works of the new company printer. Tom Brennan will be here to offer up his moment of shame. And I'll be asking for yours as well. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The next time you're sitting around with friends and looking for something to talk about, try this. What's the stupidest thing you've ever done? I was once given the keys to a neighbor's truck. I barely knew how to drive, certainly not a standard. But I was too young and too proud and too stupid to say so. Pick up those boxes in the back alley, I was told. I panicked, popped the clutch, and ripped both side mirrors off the truck on the alley's brick walls. And so when Tom Brennan rode in to tell me about his attempt to fit in on a construction crew in his one fateful day of shame, well, let's just say he had me at once upon a time. Tom had graduated from a New England college with a degree in art history and a plan to pursue architecture, but instead of taking the usual path through an internship with an architecture firm, he came to North Carolina to work construction.
You know, to go from classrooms of 10 and 12 people discussing various paintings or art theories or whatever the case may be, to getting to work at 7 a.m. and showing up and working predominantly with migrant workers and folks who hadn't graduated from high school and things like that. That was very different, obviously.
How did you fit in, or how didn't you fit in? What was that like?
Well, it took a little while to adjust, but I think, my boots were very, very clean when I showed up and very, very new. Yeah,
literally and figuratively.
Literally and figuratively. And I don't think that any of the guys who I was working with thought of me as much of a threat.
They're probably taking bets on how long you'd last.
They treated me all right. It took me a while to get them to allow me to do stuff more than just sweeping the floors, you know, holding hammers, that sort of thing, which is what I expected. I mean, I had no experience with this. I had no prior construction experience. I knew how to use a hammer, but I didn't know how to use a hammer, you know, like these guys did. And cussing was a pretty big deal in the construction world.
Not only that, cussing well.
Cussing well, exactly. And I found once I was able to sort of hit my stride with that, it was like a secret code. And everybody feels comfortable once you start cussing.
How about your boss? How about your supervisor? Did you get any respect from him?
Not even close. He told it like it was. He had been doing this job for 26 years and did not like me initially. I mean, really, he would call me just terrible names.
Well, why should he like you? I mean, after all, it's like you're the son of the nephew of the owner who's, you know, showed up and he has to put up with you.
Exactly. This was all part of it because I was like, well, you know, I'm new. I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. And I really felt like I was more in the way initially. And he really made that known. He would call me names, and like I had this coat early in the morning when you're starting, the sun's not up. And so it's dark, and it's windy, out on this job site that's completely devoid of any trees. We've successfully taken down all of the trees to put up the building, so it's very, very cold. And I was ill-prepared as far as coats are concerned, or coats that would sort of give me any sort of respect, like these men who are walking around in their, you know, heavy-duty cotton twill with paint all over them and caulk and tears and, you know, elbow patches, this sort of thing. My boss made me well aware that I did not have that. I had this sort of very straightforward brown quilted, relatively nondescript coat, but it did have this quilting pattern to it. And he would just mercilessly make fun of me for this. I earned the name Patches, the nickname Patches. He was under the impression that the coat was like stitched together from a series of rags or patches or something.
Did you quilt that in your office?
Exactly. He would ask me if my mom could make him one, and you know, all this stuff. Oh, Patches, you know, here's this burly guy, and he's singing at me, just mocking me, you know, Patches, all this sorts of stuff. And, you know, come on, get your little girl's coat, let's go outside, all this sorts of stuff.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Tom Brennan did, however, learn enough to be assigned to operate a real piece of equipment, a forklift, a very large forklift called a Lull.
It was big, and it was yellow, and it had these four tires that were probably 4 feet in diameter. And I remember I had been late for the first time. This was probably 11 months in. So I'm already late, and I'm already flustered. And I get behind the wheel of the Lull, and my job for the past probably 3 weeks had been mixing mortar, sort of the grout, for a firewall that we were building in an elevator shaft inside of the building. So I would go and mix just these monstrous quantities of grout, you know, barrels full of grout, this gray, gloopy stuff. And then I would have to transfer it from the big mixing vat into this little jury-rigged box we had put on the forks of the big Lull. And then I'd hop behind the wheel of the Lull and deftly maneuver around to the front of the building. We were mixing around back. And I drive around to the front of the building in order to drive, literally drive into the building as it was being built. At this point, the walls were all on. There were these big precast concrete walls were on. And so there was really only one way into the building, and that was through what was to be the front door, which was this grand sort of two-story atrium space. So in I drive around, and the opening was not, you know, not that big, but big enough to sort of sneak the machine in. And then there was this whole lattice work of the steel off of which the walls had been hung and the floors were set and the structure of the building.
This is in that front wall, or this is above you in the ceiling itself?
This is exposed, you know, throughout the building.
Right.
This geometric pattern of I-beams, as they were called. And the aesthetic that the architect was going for, I guess, was this very sort of rough, uncovered look. Here are the bones of the building. And so there were several beams that spanned the entranceway that I had to drive in under with this large machine. So I'd sneak in, you know, I'd have the boom down, and I'd drive in under all these beams, and then I had to sort of gently raise the bucket of the grout, boom it up to the second floor where there was this catwalk where probably six or eight of our guys were working, helping unload the grout and then transfer it to the mortar pans for the masons who are doing the actual laying of the brick. So I drive in, and I boom up the arm about 20 feet up into the air, extend it out. All the guys who are up on this catwalk, unload, unload, unload. And then, for whatever reason, as opposed to putting the boom arm back down, like I had countless times before, and then backing out of the entrance, I just threw the Lull into reverse and backed out of the building with the Lull hanging 20 feet up in the air, this big boom 20 feet up in the air. And I ran into the steel. The Lull just stopped. Boom! If you've ever backed into a light pole or another car, and there's just, it's not even a sound, it's just a feeling, you know, where it's just a thud that resonates deeply. Multiply that times about 10, because this is a 1,200-pound beam, and I was driving a 2,000-pound forklift.
And everybody stops in the building.
Everybody stopped. I literally sat there just staring up through the grate of this forklift, just staring for about 30 seconds. I'm fired.
How much damage had you done to that beam, that big beam?
To the boom or to the steel?
Either. I don't know.
The boom had its paint scratched, which tells you how heavy duty this piece of equipment was. But it was the beam. This was the beam when you open the front door, this glass front door, you open it up. First beam you see. Big bend in it. Big kink. Not structurally sound.
I was going to say, was there any danger of stuff coming down at that point?
I think this was part of that dead silence that filled the area.
Is Thomas
everybody
about to
just
be
sort
squashed?
Of bracing. Bracing. Because we're probably 80 guys from various trades working throughout the building. It was only a two-story building. And everything just stopped. And I sat there and said, you know, when it was clear that the building was not going to come collapsing down around me, immediately I thought, and this was probably not the best thought, but this is what I thought. I thought, well, maybe if I just put the boom down and drive and just back out, nobody will notice. I'll be fine.
Someone else hit that baseball through the window, right? I wasn't there.
I had been working there for 11 months, and I was only going to work there for a year. I had sort of given myself a year, and I was so close. I was like, I'm just going to put it down and drive away. And then I sort of, as my gaze dropped from the I-beam directly above me to the catwalk where I had just dropped off this whole load of grout, I see our entire workforce, all 8 guys with my company, standing there. They're not working. They're just staring at me. And so I said, well, I guess I have, you know, there are witnesses, so much for plan A. So I put the boom down, and I back out, and I say, well, I've got to go tell my boss. You know, it's like dead man walking as I walk to find my boss. I find him, and he immediately says, Thomas, what was that noise? And I say, oh, good, you heard that. I said, if you want to fire me, feel free. But I just ran the lull into the building. And he says, what? I say, yeah, I just backed the lull into the building, into the steel. And he just starts to laugh and laugh and laugh.
He hasn't seen it yet, right?
He hasn't. Yeah, exactly. He hasn't seen it yet. And so he says, well, let's go take a look. And so we walk back across the front of the building. And he's just sort of shaking his head. Oh, patches. What are we going to do with you? And then we walk into the front of the building, and he sees the beam. Nice big kink in it. Can't miss it. He didn't have to ask me which one I hit. And he sees it and he starts to laugh again. And then says, well, damn, Patches. You really hit that. I said, yeah, I did. And he says, well, you think you can back into it the other way and knock it back into place? And he's kidding at this point. Yeah. So again, I was, whoa. And then he says, go tell the project manager. Go tell him we need to order another beam. You know, and that's it. And he's walking away. And then he just turns around and he walks away.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. We're not done yet. Tom Brennan was still convinced that this accident with the forklift was going to get him fired.
And the rest of the day passes. The owner winds up showing up. I'm not called over to testify or put down any sort of deposition. So that could be a good thing. That could be a bad thing.
I would imagine the other workers are giving you a bit of a hard time at this
point. Oh, my goodness. You know, they were just... Most of them had been working there for 10 years, and they had never seen something quite this stupid, I don't think.
Given them something to talk about.
To literally keep this boom in the air and just drive around. I mean, it's just so stupid. And they were just ripping me the rest of the day. All the other trades, all the other workers. You know, like, hey, you know, good work on that beam there. That was nice. Or, you know, the ones who knew I was going to be an architect or wanted to be an architect would say, you know, is that sort of your interpretation here? You thought the design wasn't good enough as it was? You've sort of taken matters into your own hands, as it were. So then the end of the day comes. We're all back in the job trailer on the job site. My boss walks in, changes his boots, is still giving me a hard time. I can't believe you did that. You know, give me a break. I don't even know why we keep you around, this sort of thing. And he's laughing. And then just as he leaves, as he's about to walk out of the door, he turns and looks at me. And we're probably the only two people left in the trailer at this point. And he looks at me and he says, "Thomas, if you ain't breaking nothing, you ain't doing nothing." And then he turns and he walks out of the door. And that was it.
It's like a compliment.
It was this ultimate act of forgiveness. It was the largest compliment I have probably ever received. I was so relieved. Just that sentence, "If you ain't breaking nothing, you ain't doing nothing."
Tell me something. Did, after 11 months of feeling a little bit like an outsider or wondering if you fit in with this construction gang, did that event and that one piece of advice alter your sense of your place there?
Very much so. If for no other reason, in my own mind, to sort of finally lose whatever little remnant of self-consciousness I had. You can't mess up much bigger than that. When it was almost like I had been anointed finally as a construction worker, you know, you've had your big mess up and now let's just sort of move off of this.
Well, a tip of the yellow hard hat to Tom Brennan for the humility and the humor with which he tells his story. But let me also use it as a challenge for the rest of you. What was your big mess up? The moment when you felt that the sands of time had stopped and everyone was watching you? And how did that change you? What did you learn? You can get to me by sending me a short note at our website, thestory.org, or you can call and leave a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. Joanne Sharon joined me last week to tell me about her New Year's resolution. She had decided to try and live without plastic, but it was quickly becoming apparent to her that she had a lot to learn.
I got some crackers, and I thought, oh, yay, that one comes in cardboard. And I opened it up, and it was plastic.
Inside the cardboard.
Right. So now it's, I can't buy that anymore. And I'm thinking, well, do I have to make, well, we're thinking about now we got to make our own crackers and our own pasta. The only thing, it's the yogurt. I found one that comes in a bottle. I'm so happy because I love my yogurt. But
what about cheese? Yeah.
Cheese is, Well, I found two products that they come in kind of a wax parchment type paper. So it looks like that's going to be the thing about cheese. Now, another thing I just thought, you know, we're running out of dishwasher soap or liquid soap. And I'm thinking, oh, no, I have just a little bit left. How am I going to do the dishes?
Well, listeners from all over came to Joanne's rescue. And I should point out early on that I had asked Joanne about that little plastic window in the box of pasta. Lori from Los Angeles wrote to correct my misapprehension. Not everything that's clear and shiny is plastic, Dick. The windows on envelopes and pasta boxes, for instance, may be a harmless cellophane. Lori also said that she was fascinated listening to Joanne Sharon's resolve not to buy any more plastic, and she had a couple of hints. She said, you need sheets? Try Jersey Knit Tea Sheets. They're soft like flannel or an old T-shirt, but the kicker is they come in a drawstring bag made of the same knit cotton material. No plastic. And those styrofoam packing peanuts, you can now get non-styrofoam peanuts made out of cornstarch or some such thing. Apparently they just dissolve in water. Deborah wrote in from Nebraska to say you can get bamboo sheets that come in a cloth bag and not plastic. They're very soft, and she likes them better than the cotton ones. Juliana wrote in from Vermont, welcome to my world. I have avoided plastic myself for years. Now, as to the dishwasher soap, Juliana writes, I ran out a few days ago and just today refilled two of the bottles I had not thrown out for the second time. My daughter, she says, is also on the team. I drive school bus trips and I point out packaging to the kids. Juliana says, I have condemned single-serving, single-use containers. Carolyn from Grand Rapids wrote to say that here in Grand Rapids, we have a wonderful little fair trade store called Global Infusion, and they carry bulk dish soap, shampoo and conditioner, laundry soap and even olive oil. It's changing, Joanne. It's just changing. Slowly. If you have something you'd like to contribute, go to our website, thestory.org, and let me know what you're thinking. I am Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.